National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, this is the National Gallery Podcast and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's show, a sneak preview of our big autumn exhibition and Andrew Graham Dixon gets his teeth into Caravaggio's Boy Bitten by a Lizard. But we start with news of a show that's just opened at the gallery. Exhibitions tend to celebrate the big names of art, but this time the focus is on the people behind the scenes. Close Examination, Fakes, Mistakes and Discoveries explores how our scientists, curators and conservators turn detective to reveal the truth about paintings that aren't all they seem. Sometimes they've been misattributed to the wrong artist, sometimes they've been altered to suit the tastes of the day, sometimes they're out-and-out fakes. Curator Betsy Wiesman told me a few of their tales, beginning with a painting acquired by the gallery in 1990. Said to be a portrait of Martin Luther by Hans Holbein the Younger, something wasn't quite right.
When this painting was acquired by the gallery in 1990, it originally had a bright blue background, and the man's hat was not this sort of conical shape, but more like a skull cap fitted very closely to the top of his skull. When the painting arrived in the gallery, it was examined very closely, and it was realized that that blue background had been added later, that it wasn't original to the painting. So some cleaning tests were done, a cross-section was taken and examined very carefully, and two things were found out. One, that that blue lay on top of a layer of varnish, which is usually the last thing you put on a piece of painting, so that it was not original to the painting. And when the pigments were analyzed, it was found to contain Prussian blue, which was a pigment only discovered in the 18th century, so more than 200 years after the painting itself was made. So when scientists and conservators started their work on restoring the painting, it came up as you see now, that the background is a light brown in color with this horizontal grain to imitate wood, which was a very common background in 15th century German portraits. And you can also see that the man's hat has now been revealed to have this kind of funny conical shape. One of the things that researchers were intrigued to try and find out is why these changes might have been made. The use of Prussian blue indicated that it was done after about 1710, and there was a reproduction of the painting made towards the end of the 18th century that showed it in its earlier state with the blue background and the round hat. So it must have been changed sometime in the 18th century, and it was probably done to increase the appeal of the painting, because obviously a painting of someone so famous as Martin Luther by an artist so famous as Hans Holbein the Younger was going to bring a lot higher price.
So we now know that it's not by Hans Holbein, but we still don't know who the artist is.
No, absolutely not. He's identified as the master of the Murnauer portrait because we know that the sitter in this portrait is Alexander Murnauer, but we don't know who the artist is by name.
So how will the works be displayed, Betsy? Are we going to be able to see some of this kind of scientific work in progress?
Absolutely. We're hoping that in the exhibition, the visitor can, in a way, trace the steps of the researchers. So in the case of the portrait of Alexander Murnauer, we'll show an image of the painting with the blue background. We'll show the infrared reflectogram, which reveals the artist's underdrawing, the preliminary sketch he made. And we'll also show you a large blow-up of the paint cross-section, which shows very clearly that the blue paint was applied over a layer of varnish. So we're hoping that people will be able to make their own discoveries and feel as if they're following the detective stories.
Then, of course, the thing about these kind of investigations is that they're ongoing. So at any point in the future, as works go in for conservation, you know, more stories will come out.
Absolutely. And even as we were putting the exhibition together, we discovered new things and surprising things about paintings in the exhibition that caused us to rethink. And it's, for me as a curator, it's been fascinating to work with colleagues in the scientific and conservation departments because I've really found out so much about the paintings.
Betsy Wiesman. If you'd like to try your own hand at spotting fakes and mistakes, come along to the National Gallery. The exhibition's open until the 12th of September and admission is free. Now for a preview of a major exhibition that's opening at the gallery in October. Venice, Canaletto and His Rivals is supported by Credit Suisse and celebrates the flowering of vedute or view painting in Venice in the 18th century. Canaletto is perhaps the best-remembered vedute painter today, but as the show will reveal, there were many other brilliant artists working in Venice, all producing views for foreign tourists. To accompany the exhibition, the gallery is making a film that explores the experience of these visitors to the city. Leah Caribbean went to find out more.
Well, I'm delighted to say that the National Gallery podcast is on its travels again, and I'm here beside the waters of the Bacino di San Marco in Venice with one of the presenters of the film to accompany Canaletto and His Rivals, the Italian-born art historian and 18th century expert Adriano Aimonino. Adriano, even at this early hour, we're surrounded by tourists and travellers, and being here, it's not hard to see why they've come. But in the 18th century, when travelling was so much more difficult, why did foreign visitors, and the British in particular, come to Venice?
But first of all, I need to say that actually in the 18th century, very few people could afford to come to Venice, or was really the chosen few, not as you can see nowadays, we are surrounded by thousands and thousands of people. In the 18th century, only, let's say, the aristocracy or the upper classes could afford to come to Venice. And Venice was, with Rome and Florence, really the center of the Grand Tour. They would have gone to Rome for, let's say, antiquity and culture, and to Venice for completely different reasons, which were mainly, basically, the entertainments of Venice. So Venice was really, let's say, the stage of Europe, a city where you could gamble, enjoy the carnival, enjoy the festivities, and mix with the local population and local aristocracy, something that in Rome was much more difficult to do.
Now, you're here to film the modern revival of a civic festival held on Ascension Day called the Festa della Senza. And in the 18th century, this really was one of the highlights of the Venetian calendar. What went on?
As we are now, we are on the Bacino di San Marco in front of the Piazzetta, the Bucintoro, this huge galley completely gilded, enormous. The one that you see nowadays, it's nothing compared to the one that you could have seen in the 18th century. So the Bucintoro, this huge ship, would have hosted the Doge, the Senate, and members of the Maggior Consiglio, of the Great Council of Venice. And the rowers were the citizens of Venice. So basically all the structure of the Venetian society would have been symbolized in the Bucintoro. Then this huge parade with the Bucintoro in the middle and other ships and galleys would have gone to the Lido. And in the Lido, where the Lido basically is the only strip of land dividing the lagoon from the main sea, from the Adriatic Sea. So they would have reached the sea, the open sea, the Adriatic, and the Doge would have given to the sea a gold ring as a token of the wedding of the Venetian power with the sea. And really, this was actually a metaphor of the dominion of Venice over the whole Mediterranean, or the East Mediterranean, actually.
Now, for foreign visitors, this event had quite a lot of significance, didn't it? I mean, what were they drawing from this whole idea of the Bucintoro sort of encapsulating the whole of Venetian society?
Especially for the British, and especially for the in the first half of the 18th century, of course, Venice on paper was the perfect society, the society that Aristotle devised. So basically a mixture of the one, the few, and the many. So a mixture of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, which in the Venetian constitution was represented by the Doge, the Senate, and the Maggior Consiglio. And the fact that through a complex system of controlling, the Doge didn't have any power, actually. So for the British was really important because it represented, especially for the Whig, who was, let's say, the dominant party of the first half of the 18th century, it represented the ideal way of ruling a country.
Now, the exhibition, I know, is going to have a number of spectacular depictions of the festa, which, in the light of what you've just said, are obviously much more rich in meaning than we might at first think. Is this, to some extent, true of all vedute, or view painting, made in Venice, both for people who bought them and for the people who saw them when they were on display back home, that they were actually very much more than just simply views of Venice? I mean, like elaborate postcards, they're more than that.
Absolutely. I mean, on one hand, you can consider the Canaletto's vedutes as simple souvenir of what of their experience of the Grand Tour in Venice, but actually, of course, they bore a symbolic meaning, which was actually, I've been on my Grand Tour, I've been back, so I'm already part of the establishment of the ruling classes and of the chosen few of this country. Having a Canaletto view, or many of them even better, on your walls was really a symbol of belonging to the ruling classes of the nation, actually. With, remember, this is absolutely fundamental, Canaletto was only part of a cultural system, of a system of cultural references. So you would have hung in your country houses or in your urban houses of London Canaletto with Panini, with Pompeo Batoni, with Old Masters, etc., etc., etc. So Venice was only one of the elements on this mosaic of cultural reference to Italy, actually, but was one of the most important. So having a Canaletto on the walls alongside with something else, but really having a Canaletto on the walls, and especially, let's say, a good one or many of them as a set, was a status symbol more powerful than any else in the 18th century, indeed.
Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Leah Caribbean talking to Adriano Aimonino. Venice, Canaletto and his rivals, doesn't open until October, but as it's likely to be very popular, tickets are already on sale. See www.nationalgallery.org.uk for details. Next, Michelangelo Merisa da Caravaggio lived perhaps the darkest and most dangerous life of any of the great painters. He was notorious for brawling, and at the height of his fame killed a pimp, Ranuccio Tommasoni, and was forced to flee from Rome. Art critic Andrew Graham Dixon puts this murder at the centre of his new biography of the artist, exploring how Caravaggio's violent life fed into his work. He spoke to me about one of the most popular pictures by Caravaggio in the collection, Boy Bitten by a Lizard.
One of the documents that I came across in the course of researching my biography of Caravaggio describes a man very angry with another man who's his enemy, biting his finger at him. And what this symbolised was that if I ever catch up with you late at night, I'll get out my knife and I'll emasculate you. It's symbolic of castration, of injury to the sexual parts. And that language of the streets was something that Caravaggio also brought into painting. He famously put real people into paintings, posed them, painted them. And that's what he's done here. He's taken a young model, he's posed him in his workshop, he's painted him, it's a picture painted for sale. The scene draws on that language of popular vengeance or injury in the sense that this young man has been enjoying the unalloyed, apparently unalloyed pleasures, sensual pleasures, eating fruit, and he's reached into this innocent-looking collection of fruit and his finger's being bitten by a lizard. And one of the things that's interesting about the picture is that the flowers, and there's a jasmine and there's a rose, and the flowers symbolise love, but more specifically they symbolise carnal love. Phillida Melandroni, who was what Caravaggio's possibly favourite female model, probably his lover, possibly a whore for whom he pimped in his spare time, she carries a jasmine at her breast in a famous portrait that sadly was destroyed in the Second World War. So I think if you put that together with the boy's suggestive undress, I think what Caravaggio is suggesting to his wealthy And remember, Counter-Reformation, you have to be a bit careful about how you paint and what you paint. What he's suggesting is that this boy has fallen victim to the blandishments of love and in the process has caught what in Italy they called the French disease. In France they called the Italian disease. That the lizard that is biting his finger is a symbol of the, as it were, poison chalice of his lover, who's given him the clap, which was a very common thing to get in Rome in the 16th century, because I shouldn't laugh, it's no laughing matter. Montaigne noted that very, very few women in Rome were not engaged in the oldest profession in the world, and noted that in his day, he was writing just shortly before Caravaggio arrived in the city himself, Montaigne said that a lot of the nobility were so fond of ogling the prostitutes who, as they stood at their balconies, that they actually lopped the tops off their carriages. They created, you know, as it were, the world's first convertibles for the purposes of being able to look up at the ladies. It's a slight picture. It's not one of Caravaggio's greatest paintings. It's painted for sale early on when he's struggling, and according to his biographers, pictures like this, he struggled to sell them, and he was living in rags and not living very well. I think he ran a team of prostitutes. Can't prove it for sure, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that may have been what he was doing late at night. He's always out with his sword. He's always in the company of prostitutes. He paints prostitutes. It's not a great stretch that, you know, he paints them. It's quite hard to get models. Paints them, looks after them, gets a bit of free sex on the side. His fight with Ranuccio Tomasoni, the man he kills, Ranuccio's pimp. Phyllida was one of Ranuccio's girls. I think maybe Caravaggio persuaded her to work for him. So this fight could be about that. It could be about Ranuccio's wife, who Caravaggio may have had something with, or may have insulted. Caravaggio kills him with a sword blow to the groin. We know from a barber surgeon's report that he bled to death from a femoral artery. So again, wound to the groins. It's a low blow. It's, in boxing terms, is definitely below the belt. But this again may suggest that Caravaggio was attempting to inflict some kind of sexual wound. So in a way, we come back to that image of the man biting his finger at another man. So there's an extraordinary legal document where it actually says, you know, if I cut out your eye, I've got to pay you £100. If I cut out both eyes, I've got to pay you £500. If I cut off one of this chap's testicles, I've got to pay him £200. If I cut them both off, I've got to pay £1,000. So the fact that the punishments were specified means that these things obviously went on. So I'm not being sort of controversial, as it were, for the sake of it. I think this is what actually happened. The sex was at the root of it with Caravaggio and Tomasoni. And once that, and in a sense, everything that went wrong in his life stemmed from that moment. But what a great artist.
Andrew Graham Dixon, whose biography, Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane, is out this month. Come along to the gallery if you'd like to see Boy Bitten by a Lizard for yourself. We're open 10 till 6 daily and 10 till 9 on Fridays. And don't forget, if you can't make it along, you can find images of all the works in the National Gallery's collection online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for now. Until next month, goodbye.